Last time we were looking at verse 15 when God had set Paul apart from his mother's womb and called through his grace. And we zeroed in on the when issue because it's my conviction that the issues of timing are faith related. They relate to the question of what we can trust God for and how we go about that. Because most of the record of the Gospels, all four of the Gospels and Acts, create a picture of Jesus in action and the apostles in action that is not real easy for us to plug into our own day-by-day affairs, partly because that's the way history works. Even writers of secular history select their events, and they don't tell you about all the other stuff that's going on. Every day has 24 hours in it, and every hour has 60 minutes in it, and every 60 minutes has 60 seconds per minute in it, and all of that is filled up for us in the flow of our daily doings. And even in the records of Scripture, there are highlighted events. Paul identifies two in this text. One was his physical birth, and the other was his call. Those were separated by at least 30 years, perhaps, a little more or less. I just got it in my mind that because he wasn't apparently in the Sanhedrin, Saul of Tarsus was probably too young to be, because he was advancing, according to his testimony, above almost all of his contemporaries. So if he had been 40 or above, his advance would have placed him in that body called the Sanhedrin, and he wasn't a member of that, so apparently he wasn't 40 yet. So I've just had it in my mind that he was probably pretty much a contemporary of Jesus, born around the same time, give or take a few years. So he was in his, probably in his 30s, upper 30s perhaps, when he got this call. So there's that much time. When we read it, it's dismissed. We don't see the amount of years and years that go by and all of the stuff that was going on in all of those years. So in that study, we just zeroed in on the issue of timing because Paul says that God acted when he was, the text says, he was pleased. When he was pleased, he did this or whatever. So the issue of God's involvement in producing the foundations for our confidence that are given in the book of Galatians, because Galatians is written to enable us to have a strong confidence in the truth of the gospel. Well, in order for us to have that strong confidence, we have to have some very clearly established facts. And the issue of the records of Jesus' ministry and the Acts of the Apostles give you an unrealistic picture if the preaching that's done on the basis of them is Jesus did this and he'll do it for you. He did this for this person and he'll do it for you. That's often the message. And they use Hebrews that Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that means he'll do the same things yesterday, today, and forever. But that's patently not true. You're the same person you were yesterday. And you're not doing the same things you did when you were 10 years old. Or 20 years old. So it's a little bit unrealistic. So in the issue of what we are actually expecting from God, we need to be very careful that we understand what the details are. So I think that that when thing comes into play. It was my argument last time and continues to be God's typical 24/7 behavior is typical stuff. So that you really can't even distinguish what is God and what is not. It's just the way things are happening. And Solomon even said in Ecclesiastes somewhere that nobody could tell what God was doing by the things that were happening. Because assigning this to God and assigning that to God and assigning something else to God may or may not be a valid activity. Because God has created a cause and effect universe. He has created what I call chooser producers, human beings and angels who have the ability to make choices and do actions. And in a cause and effect universe, that's going to create an automatic flow of events that God has to do very little to do. I mean, he has to do very little more than just support his dispensation of power to those chosen producers in order for this to happen. So when Paul highlights an act as of God, he is deliberately saying that God also participates in his cause and effect universe by, on certain occasions, doing special things that's inserted into the progression of the cause and effect chain that has its effect on the cause and effect chain. So the point is, God is managing the flow of his creation to an end. And we know that from the prophetic word. We know in general terms the end is going to be the ultimate kingdom. And prior to that, it's going to be the millennial kingdom of the Christ on the earth. And before that, there's going to be this time of horrible judgment on the earth called the tribulation and all that. God is managing his creation and moving it in that direction. So if he needs to do something special in order to get the track running in the right direction, he will. So when God was pleased, that just means, okay, he saw this need to be done here. And when you think about the Apostle Paul, his physical birth made him a present actor in this world. And what would have been the outcome if he hadn't been the Apostle Paul? I don't know if you thought about it or not, but Jesus trained 12 men. And then when he got ready to use a man to take the gospel to the uttermost parts of the earth and write most of the New Testament, he didn't choose anyone of the 12 he trained. He picked somebody else, brought him in. So obviously God is inserting things into the flow of history so that he can direct it. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. But by way of review, God separated Paul from his mother's womb and he called Paul into this plan. And there are certain typical actions in the cause and effect thing that God is guiding, but there are certain atypical works that God does, inserting it here and here and here whenever it suits his plan. That makes it a little bit more difficult for us to know what to expect from him, because we don't know whether to expect nothing in terms of any extra inserting into the thing, or whether we should expect something special in order to, and this shows up in our prayer life. We don't know what to pray for, even as we ought. And even when John says, we know that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us, and if he hears us, we have it. Well, the problem with that is knowing what his will is. Being able to ask according to his will guarantee the outcome, but do you know what the will is? And Paul admitted that there are times, in Romans 8, where we don't know what to pray for. So it's all involved in how we relate to him and what we expect from him. Now, in Paul's comments here in Galatians, there's an inevitable production of a perspective on how life really ought to be viewed, and that view of life is that it's a typical process where the rules of the harvest dominate. Paul said in Galatians 6, don't be deceived. If you sow it, you'll reap it. You ought to view life that way. It's going to be a typical harvest of seed sown. But there are also going to be occasions where the God of those rules addresses the flow of history by his own special adjustments at certain points along the way, because he's got this plan and he's going to fulfill it. It's going to happen the way he said it was. And those special adjustments are not violations of the typical. They're just God participating in his own typical universe. He becomes one of the actors that causes some of the effects in the flow. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look at the two things that Paul highlights here in verse 15, his physical birth and his calling by grace. And at issue, I believe, in all of Paul's thinking is the master plan, the outcome down the line, and the gazillion details that are involved. We've said this before, you heard it before, but there are currently on this planet more than 6 billion chooser producers. That means there are more than 6 billion humans who are making choices and producing actions that are kicking the law of the harvest into gear. 6 billion directions that you can run. Because everyone is making their choices and following through with their actions, and that's causing responses and reactions in the cause and effect universe. When you have that many, and that's just the human side, there is an innumerable host of angelic chooser producers who are also making choices and taking actions that are affecting the creation. So, if the rules of the harvest are real, if you're going to reap what you sow, and you have 6 billion plus human beings making choices and doing things, their actions are going to have an effect on the downline outcome. And that means that the downline outcomes are all extremely iffy. That's the reason why nobody can prophesy just out of human wisdom. It takes a connection to omniscience from God in order for anybody to declare what will be, even if it's just 2 weeks down the line. Because there's too much going on from too many directions for anybody to be able to say, this is going to happen. So, if the outcomes are all iffy, then obviously there can't be prophecy and there can't be a grand plan. Unless there are two things going on. One of them is that there is a general direction in the cause and effect flow. In other words, there's a general predisposition of the majority of the choices and actions that people are taking to move in a given direction. Out of 6 billion choosers and producers, the majority are moving like this. There may be one shooting off this way and maybe even retrograding in parts of a few. But in general terms, the flow is it's this way. And I don't know how to illustrate that except that I know that in human history there are periods of time when there seems to come over all of humanity a certain attitude. And when that happens, everything... I mean, for example, when Reagan said, tear down this wall, the Iron Curtain, the wall in Berlin and all that, there was a groundswell in humanity that resisted and rebelled against this authoritarian communist kind of stuff. And not only did that wall come down, but governments toppled in one country after another because there was this groundswell of people saying, we're not going to put up with this anymore. Well, that was a general direction that you can't point to and say, this person started that or this person caused that. It's just moving. And you've seen it in cycles in history too. The French Revolution was another example where just all of a sudden everybody decided they were going to go this way. So, there's got to be some of that. If you're going to have that many chooser producers, there's got to be something that's generally moving them in a general direction in the same way. And then there's also got to be some specific adjustments along the way. We got a train going by right now. The reason that that train is going to end up where it's going is because it's running on two rails, a track, and it cannot deviate from it. It's going to run on it. If the world was set up like that train, it wouldn't be hard to figure out how everything was going to be because you could just look at the tracks. The fact is, you can take a toy train that is supposed to run on tracks, and if you can get it to run without the electrical connections of the track, it'll run on this floor. The problem with it running on this floor is that the wheels will spin at different rates because of the gravity or the friction and all that, and so you won't be able to tell where it's going to go. But you can still get it to go where you want to because you're big enough to nudge it. And you can get it to go where you want to periodically nudging it. We used to do that with a tire. You get a tire rolling, and you were playing with this tire, rolling it down the road, and you wanted to keep it in track, so you just hit it on one side, and then you hit it on the other side, and you could get it to go. And that's kind of the way the flow of life runs, with God specifically nudging at particular points, and that's Paul's appeal here. There are actually some theologies that say everything's on a track, and it's all But the reality is, in a cause and effect universe, with God giving dispensations of power to act and do with a certain amount of restraint on his own part, that there are a lot of things that are just happening because people are making choices, and that's setting things in motion. Well, you can't have a universe running on happenstance like that and have any kind of plan. So if God has a plan, and Paul says he does, then obviously there are going to be some highlighted events. Even in this book, in Galatians, it says that when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son 4,000 years into the mix. So everything was building to a point, but when he reached it, it was time, and God acted. Well, that's what Paul is actually saying in verse 15, is that there was a time when it was necessary for the grand plan to function by God inserting a particular individual, and that was Paul. He separated me from my mother's womb. So when you look at life flowing that way, you have to understand that there are many things that are just happening because that's the way the cause and effect universe runs, and there are going to be times when God's actually going to do something special. He's going to stick something special into the mix, and it's going to alter the flow or the direction. Somebody asked me, I don't think it was in this class, so this won't be just a boring repetition, but somebody asked me, how do you deal with the law of the harvest and the fact that sometimes what comes is a whole lot worse and other times it's just a little, it wasn't in this class. I mean, when you sow, when grandma's driving down the freeway, like in Lincoln County or in North Carolina, grandma's driving down the highway, she's got her daughter and her granddaughter in the car, and she decides that she's going to cut across the interstate divider so she can go back the other way. And so she just turns her car and goes and pulls right in front of the semi. Everybody's dead. Well, how many times have we turned left without regard and got away with it? Didn't cause any problem. How is it that sometimes your action creates a tremendous response or reaction, and other times it seems like it didn't really affect much of anything? And my answer to that is there's a lot of mitigation in the consequences on God's part by restraining his reaction. He's free to do that. That's called grace. He doesn't have to, but many times he does. He mitigates the harvest so that instead of getting 180 bushel to the acre of whatever it was he sowed, we only get a couple because he's being gracious. He could be very hard and make us pay the full price of a foolish choice, but if he had or did, characteristically, I wouldn't be here. I've done too many dumb things. I should have been dead a long time ago. That's the way it works. So, let's think about why Paul talks about his physical birth and his call in verse 15 in light of this reality that Paul is trying to get the Galatians to trust God, but he has to do it within the context of trust, which means you got to understand how God does things in order to be able to trust him to some degree. Paul's physical existence within God's creation was one of those choices that would make their own set of adjustments to the flow. And according to Paul, the action of separating him from his mother's womb was one of those things. The question for us is actually two. One is, why did Paul decide to elevate his physical birth to the level of a divine adjustment within the plan and not everybody's? Because we know that everybody is separated from their mother's womb by God's action if the fact is that children are a heritage of the Lord, that he is the one who enables births to happen. If that's the case, I mean, we all know that there are people who can go through the same actions. These two people can go through the exact same actions as these two people. And these two people will never have children. And almost every time these two people get involved, they have a kid. Who's deciding that? It's not as if there's something flawed in the actions, the choices in the actions. It's the harvest thing. And in a very real sense, God's the God of the harvest in terms of who's going to have children and who's not. So you get into this problem of, okay, Paul says that when it pleased God to reveal His Son in me, this God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by His grace, when He was pleased to reveal His Son in me, these background issues of God being the one who separated me from my mother's womb and called me, why does Paul elevate his physical birth to one of these levels of God's special intervention thing? Because any typical event could be exalted by the writer to the special status. I mean, in the final analysis, you can take anything that happens and say, okay, this was a result of God's intervention. If you have the wisdom and ability to tell that that's really the case, and not just the way it happened. I mean, this is where all the skepticism about prayer comes in, because the believer will pray and then God will do something and it appears that that prayer was answered in this way, but the unbeliever will say, well, it would have happened that way anyway, even if you hadn't prayed. It's just the way it is. So that's where this cynicism and skepticism about prayer often from the unbeliever's perspective, but a lot of times believers are responsible for that because they claim that God did something that He really didn't do. And a lot of times we simply don't know because we're not smart enough to figure it out. It seems to me, though, that Paul is deliberately saying that there is this special intervention by God. And one of the questions that we have to deal with is, when is something a special intervention and when is it not? Because that's where the issues of our confidence come together, is being able to say, God did this and somebody else did that. I mean, people are forever blaming God for things that the scriptures would assign to someone else, to the devil or whatever. I mean, there's this tendency on man's part to run everything back to God, and God says, no, wait a minute, I don't want credit for everything because I gave dispensations of power to personal creatures, and I have allowed them to make their choices and take their actions and cause these reactions, but I'm not the one who caused that reaction in the direct sense. I just let it happen. So blame me for not stopping it if you want to, but don't give me credit for it because I didn't do it. And of course, then there are those who say, well, if he really wanted to stop it, he could. Well, that's a duh. Sure he could have. That's a whole different issue. But I think that we need to understand that Paul clearly intended to cause his readers to think about God's involvement either at or from the physical separation from his mother's womb as a special thing that God did. That's the first question, is why does he elevate this separation from his mother's womb to this level of a special act? And then secondly, what did Paul's birth actually signify in the sense of what he's doing with the Galatians? Because he wants the Galatians to believe his words. Well, what does the fact that he was separated from his mother's womb have to do with me being more confident or you being more confident that his words are true? I think that those are the two issues. How does Paul elevate his separation to his special status thing? And what was the birth issue in the context? What's the contribution made here? And I think there are several things going on here. First of all, Paul wants the Galatians to believe what he has to say because faith in the words that God gives is the means of life. Everywhere in the scriptures that you turn, life is connected to whether you trust what God says or not. That's the issue. Bottom line, you trust me, you'll get the outcome of that trust, which is invariably some dimension of life, and you don't trust me, and your unbelief is going to squelch that experience of whatever dimension of life you would have had. The issue in scriptures is believing what he says. Is this true or not true? course, you have to understand what he means by what he says, but nonetheless, once you've made that decision, it's either true or not true. Paul wrote this book in order to enhance the confidence of the Galatians in the face of contradiction and deception. Well, I believe that the physical birth of the Apostle Paul was the physical birth of the primary messenger of the New Testament, as it's turned out in history, and that it addresses the question of Paul's statement in Romans 10 about how faith comes. He says, how will they hear unless someone is sent to tell them? And so Paul's existence in God's world was deliberate because God had already decided he was going to generate a messenger. And he told Ananias. After Saul was confronted and blinded by the Shekinah on the road to Damascus, he went into Damascus and he spent time praying and fasting, and God sent Ananias, or told Ananias to go and pray for him so that the scales would fall off, and And Ananias said, I ain't going to go. I'm not putting my neck in the noose. That guy's been after us to hound us. He's going to throw me in jail if I go over there. And God said to him, go. He is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name to the nations. Well, that was God just telling Ananias why Paul had ever been born. Because God was going to create a messenger that would generate words that were words from God so that people could have the life that comes from believing the truth. So that's part of why he brings up the physical birth thing, is because there has to be a messenger, and Paul is the chosen messenger. But additionally, I think the words about his physical birth necessarily address whether the hearers are going to embrace the issue that Paul is making in this book, and that is that life is by grace through faith. So that there are two issues, grace and faith. And the physical birth of the Apostle Paul as the messenger is a classic demonstration of the issues of grace and faith. In Ephesians chapter 1, Paul says that in order to make grace known, God predestined us according to the steps in Galatians chapter 1 is he predestined us so that he could make known the riches of the glory of his grace. So grace is best known when it's connected to God's sovereign determinations. Well, physical birth is very much a classic example of that very reality. No one who's born can ever, except those people who think they were on the scene beforehand. But no normal person who's ever born can point back and say, I'm responsible for my birth because I made certain choices back then before I was born, and that's the reason why I'm here now. The reality of physical birth is that the child had absolutely nothing to say about whether he's going to be in this world or not. He is the production of some other people's choices, including God's. And in a very real sense, the foundation of grace in the Scriptures is this issue of God's determination in contrast to human initiative. John makes the point in the first chapter of his Gospel that those who received Christ were empowered to become the children of God, not those who were born of the flesh or of the will of the flesh or by bloods, but by the will of God or by the choice determination of God. And what John is doing initially, John's name means Yahweh's gracious. In the Gospel of John, he is initially making sure that the issue of grace is clear, and the bottom line of the issue of grace is God decides whether he's going to take an action or not, whether he's going to exercise an initiative or not. And the lives of countless human beings, as well as angels, are going to be impacted by what God chooses to do, and nobody can force his hand. He chooses or not. He rules among his creation as a sovereign. And that's fundamental to the issue of grace, and it's fundamental to our ability to trust in life because of grace. Because before men can ever get down to the brass tacks of living for God, they have to come to grips with the reality that He is the ultimate determiner. He's the one who makes the decisions, and it's their responsibility to embrace them. You cannot live for God as long as you're smarter than He is, as long as you're capable in your own mind of arguing with Him about what He's doing, as long as you have complaints about the choices that He's enforcing, whatever. You cannot walk with Him. It is impossible to trust a God who's smaller than you are. It's just impossible. And the grace of God stands out there on a very positive, grace is a very positive concept in the Scriptures. It doesn't have the negative overtones like judgment and wrath and all that. Grace is a conception or a perception of a characteristic that is extremely positive. But the bottom line of grace is that God decides when He's going to exercise grace and when He's not. And fundamentally, you cannot get to the position of really resting in faith in God until He's bigger than you are. Because the bottom line of every determination, if God's going to nudge this train so that it's going to go this way instead of that way, if He's going to tell the Apostle Paul on his missionary journey, don't go there, go over here. And he did that. Paul was going to go and the Spirit wouldn't allow him. He said, go over here. Well, if God's going to execute those kind of initiatives, it's going to affect people. Those are not going to hear, and these are, at least at this time. So, the bottom line in all of those issues of God saying this and not that, or that and not this, is the issue of vision. It has to do with what's the final outcome going to be, and whose vision is going to drive it? Whose decisions about goals is going to drive this whole thing? And the issue of vision, of where things are going to end up, that issue is only going to be settled when the person who is wrestling with it decides that God has a plan and He's executing the plan. And it's my job to be satisfied with the direction He's taking with it. And that's why in everything I can give thanks. Because it's His business. Not my business to run the show. It's His. And an enormous amount of human conflict with God is really over the issue of who knows best here. And quite frankly, logically, men don't have, they have nothing to stand on. God is omniscient and His wisdom is beyond description. His love is infinite and His grace is the same way. And everything about man is limited. He's not even good. He's not even good enough to be able to decide the way the creation ought to run. He certainly doesn't have the wisdom or the knowledge or any of the other things that would be big enough to control the universe as we know it. So the physical birth of an individual is the classic example of you are here because somebody else decided you would be here. And you need to live with that. Whine about it won't get you life. Begrudging the fact that you're here will not get you life. You can go into all of these attitude things and destroy your experience of life, but the fact is, there is life available, and it consists in coming to grips with the thing that physical birth is a classic illustration of, and that is your existence here is on the basis of somebody else's choice. Accept that. Not only that, but there is also the issue of getting into the swing of living for God in terms of, okay, I'm here now. I didn't ask for this. Nobody consulted me ahead of time to ask if I wanted to even get into this. I'm here, so what's next? Well, the question is, what do you want to be next? The issue is, there is life available by grace. That's the message of this book. Salvation is by grace through faith. There is life available if you are willing to believe something. But what are we supposed to believe? And that boils down to this book. The book of Galatians was just a part of a larger revelation that God decided to give to human beings. But these words are what give us the content of what we're supposed to believe, and what we're supposed to blow off is not worthy of our confidence. The sad thing about that is that the vast majority of human beings know that God has said this or that or whatever, and they just say, well, I'm not going there. Well, don't go there then. But remember, there's death everywhere except there. So if you don't want to go there, you're going to die. And you're going to. The death is going to be automatic to the unbelief. I think that's the reason why one of the major themes in the Gospel of Luke is fear. Luke knew that in order for us to live by faith, we were going to have to deal with the things that we're afraid of. And one of the biggest things we're afraid of is turning loose and letting God be the one who runs the show. Because then I can't tell him what to do. And I can't control it anymore. I've turned my loose. I've said, no, it's all yours. So, there's got to be a point where we decide that the words of God are serious words. And I believe that Paul's elevation of his physical birth to the level of a special divine intervention in the flow of the universe forces the readers to come to grips with that. That Paul's existence is here. It's not by his determination. It's a graciously intended existence. And he becomes, by that grace, the primary producer of the words of the New Covenant, the writing of the New Testament. And I think his physical birth was the way he started that off. He wanted his readers to understand that physical birth is a fundamental illustration of the message of this book, grace and faith. And then there is the second part where he says that he called me through grace. And obviously here he just brings the word grace right into the play. The issue of Paul's calling is fundamentally gracious. We've said this over and over, but when you count up all the Pharisees that existed in the first century at this particular time in history, how many of them were called like Saul of Tarsus was? And the answer is, this one. And that means that Paul's summons by grace was a clear aberration from the norm. This is God's special inserting of something into the flow. He wanted his readers to understand that the master plan was going to be affected by how God provided the revealer or the revelation of the words that people would live by as they participate in this flow of history that's working down to the final end. Paul was going to be that person, and he was that by divine calling, by grace. It's at this point that I want us to think about this idea of God being pleased. It says he was pleased to reveal a son in me. But this issue of God separating Paul from his mother's womb and calling him by grace is involved in this issue of what the translators happen to call the pleasure of God. I don't know what to think about that. The issue is, the word that's translated was pleased. In English, what voice is that? When somebody was pleased, it's passive. In Greek, this verb is as active as it can be. The interesting thing about it is in the book of Galatians, it's used 4 or 5 times. The fact is, every time that he uses it in the book of Galatians, it has to do with somebody appearing to be somewhat or making an impression on other people. And the question is, why did they translate it as a passive, that God was pleased, rather than an active, God deciding that something was good or suitable or fitting? Because the word really means to think something is good. You, dokeo, to think that this is a suitable or fitting or good thing. The text actually, I think, is strengthened because the issue is grace. If we take it out of the passive and put it back into the active and translate it something like this. When God saw fit, when he saw that this action was going to suit the situation, the need, when he decided that this would fit here. The God who saw my birth as something that would fit, he saw my calling as something that would fit, and now he sees the revelation of his Son in regard to me as something that is suitable. All of this is the whole question of whose wisdom is this universe running by? Who is the one who's making the good choices that can bring life in the context of a culture of death in our world? It's God. So it's Paul's word is really a word that has to do with how God thinks about things. And in the background, the way God thinks about things is always going to be governed by what he considers valuable, what he declares to be true in light of the outcome, the master plan, the final end. That's what's always going to be. And so if God sees that it's suitable for a certain action to be taking place at a certain time in order to accomplish short and long-term objectives, that's what he's going to do. When he sees that this will fit here. So I think that Paul is deliberately setting that, the calling by grace, he's setting that within this context of God deciding this suits the need at this particular time and for the long term. And it has to do with the calling of God. And of course that raises all kinds of questions. What is the call? Because in the scriptures, calling is a complex concept. But we all know historically what that meant. It meant, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? That was the summons. So what was it really? It wasn't just that question. What it really was the summons to Saul of Tarsus to stop his resistance to what he already intuitively knew was true. When he watched Stephen die, when he heard these truths, there was something there was true that Paul could not effectively resist. I mean, he was resisting it, but he knew it was true. That's why I said earlier that faith consists in a cessation of resistance to what you already know is true. When Jesus identified himself to Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, I think that there was a huge blood rush or drain from Paul's face. I think he was horrified. But I don't think, looking back on it, that he was all that surprised. Because, you know, when you're fighting something, and you're really not all that surprised later when you discover, yeah, I really was fighting this. So in Paul's case, the summons of God was a very upfront thing. The fact is, most of the calls of God are not that upfront. They're pretty subtle. I mean, for example, the creation summons us to God, according to Romans 1. That's a very subtle summons. It's not an in-your-face, why are you persecuting me kind of thing. Most people's salvation experience is rather minor in terms of remarkable things when you look at what happened to Saul on the road to Damascus. I mean, I went to Sunday school and heard the gospel. That's not really terribly unusual. Well, it might be these days, because you might not ever hear it in some Sunday schools, but the fact is, that's not an unusual thing for the most part, and most people come to their summons to life from God in a unremarkable kind of way. But Paul is highlighting his summons by grace because he wants the Galatians to realize that God is in the business of inserting into the flow of the normal, typical events of life certain things whenever it fits and he sees it's necessary. And I think that's a real encouragement for believers, because when we look into the things that he says in his word, we're supposed to believe them. But the ability to believe them is going to be affected by how often or not our expectation on the basis of the words is actually met. In other words, answered prayer is a remarkable stimulant to confidence.
And unanswered prayer is just as remarkable a detriment to faith. If I never see an answer, I'm going to quit praying after a while. I'm not going to trust anything I read because there's no reality there. So that's the way I see verse 15, a statement of God's deliberate, intentional intervention periodically within the normal flow of cause and effect universe. And when I mean normal, I just mean typical. God is behind the processes, and He's involved in the processes, as we argued last time. He makes it rain, but He does use instruments to make it work. There are enough of those kind of things that are typical for the 24/7 life we live. It's the atypical things that make a difference, that make an impression on us. And Paul is saying to the Galatians that there are at least two atypical things that they need to come to grips with if they're going to believe what he says. One is that God separated him from his mother's womb, and the other is he called him by grace. Okay?